Oh, the gospel according to St. Matthew, the 4th chapter.
Glory to you, O Lord.
Now when Jesus heard that John had been arrested, he withdrew to Galilee. He left Nazareth and made his home in Capernaum by the sea, in the territory of Zebulun and Naphtali, so that what had been spoken through the prophet Isaiah might be filled. Land of Zebulun, land of Naphtali, on the road by the sea, across the Jordan, Galilee of the Gentiles, people who sat in darkness have seen a great light. And for those who sat in the region and the shadow of death, light has dawned. From that time, Jesus began to proclaim, "Repent, for the kingdom has come near." As Jesus walked by the Sea of Galilee, he saw two brothers, Simon, who was called Peter, and Andrew, his brother, casting a net into the sea, for they were fishermen. And he said to them, "Follow me, and I will make you fish for people." Immediately they left their nets and followed him. As he went from there, he saw two other brothers, James, son of Zebedee, and his brother John, in the boat with their father Zebedee, mending their nets, and he called them. Immediately they left the boat and their father and followed him. Jesus went throughout Galilee, teaching in their synagogues and proclaiming the good news of the kingdom and curing every disease and every sickness among the people. The Gospel of the Lord.
Praise to you, O Christ.
It was the last minute of the game between the San Francisco 49ers and the Seattle Seahawks. Quarterback Colin Kaepernick for the 49ers decided to throw a pass to Michael Crabtree in the end zone, which hopefully would have won the game for them. However, at the last minute, defensive men from Seattle named Richard Sherman batted the ball out of Crabtree's hands, and the ball instead landed in the arms of another Seattle player. Thus, the interception, and the Seahawks win the game, go to the Super Bowl, whereas the 49ers go back to San Francisco and enjoy Ghirardelli chocolate. Immediately after that play, Fox reporter Aaron Andrews captures Richard Sherman, the man who made the big play, who still is in character from his trash talk on the field, and then tries to get something out of him. And what we get then is this long rant from Sherman about his superiority of his playing over and against the person he was defending. Quickly, social media jumped on this. Lots of Twitter activity on this. And one person decided to label Mr. Sherman as a thug. Common to the way we are as Americans right now, we started taking up sides. One in support of Sherman and who he really is, the other saying he shouldn't talk like that and going on and on about the inappropriateness of his activity. And the more we talked about that, the further and further we became divided. Because first and foremost, the easiest way to have solved the problem would have been Sherman to talk to the person who called him a thug. And that one-on-one conversation had the possibility of solving the problem. But when you add to the fact that that didn't happen, and we are people who do not have the gift of taciturnity. Taciturnity is that gift where we don't need to comment on everything. It's believed that that's the gift that came out of taking a vow of silence in the monasteries, as you learn that you don't need to comment on everything. We are not a people like that. We love to comment on everything. But even more basic than that, it spread like wildfire because we are a divided people. There are divisions among us. Now, what we want to do in this age of catastrophizing and awfulizing is to say that we are the only time in the history of the world when people are so divided, that there wasn't this kind of division at any other time. But I urge you then, brothers and sisters, to take a second look at the second lesson. As Paul, who is writing a letter to the Christians in the city of Corinth, has experienced a group of people who are divided. And get this. They're Christians, and they're divided. I know you find that hard to believe, that there could be divisions among Christians, but in Paul's day, that was happening. And among the people, they were all hanging on to their claim to fame, that I was baptized by this person, and I was baptized by this person. It would be similar here. I'm glad no one ever does this, but if people would say, yeah, I'm a firm supporter of Pastor Fisher, Or I'm a firm supporter of Pastor Lehman and what he taught me. Or I'm a firm supporter of the difference that Pastor Johnson made in my life. Now, that Mensa guy, the jury's still out on him, so I'm not going to bring him into the equation. But thank goodness we never do that here. It's unique to Paul's church, where we claim that we are better because of our lineage, that there's a division among people. And among that divided people, each person is convinced he or she is right. It's fascinating in the development of neuroscience to take a look at how the human brain has evolved over time. And neuroscientists would say there really are three components to the human brain. There's the part that's been around for the longest time, which is the one that controls most of the natural reactions in our body. It's the part of the brain that we share with reptiles. So if you are called a snake, it's entirely possible at one point you were actually acting like one. And we share that with reptiles. It's that reactive fight or flight component, that I either stay and attack or I run away because I have been threatened. But through further development, there's another piece of the brain that we share with mammals, such as dogs, and in that is that sense of what brings us together, that pack mentality, wanting to be together with others. It's what my dog at home does. She follows my wife wherever she goes in the house. And yesterday morning, my wife would be working at the computer and go to the kitchen to check lunch and back and forth. And you could just tell the dog was getting tired going back and forth. When my wife goes away, the dog lays on the front mat at the front door waiting for her to come back. It's that pack mentality. So is it not surprising then that when we feel under attack by something that's different or wrong, that we surround ourselves in a pack with people who agree with us? That we build the divisions and stay with people who agree with us and back us up, and either force them to stay that way or get rid of them if they don't serve the purpose. It's part of who we are as human beings. And the third, more recent development of the brain is the capacity for logic, the capacity for rational thinking, to think and to process through things, to understand things in time and concepts. And with that section of the brain is working, we are functioning at our fullest capacity. But too often what happens is that something frightens us, something repulses us. We act at the basic instinct, but use the logical part of our brains to come up with good reasons why it's wrong. And so we dig in our heels. We surround ourselves with people who are like us and agree with us. And we have these divisions. The sociologist E.O. Wilson said that human beings have the capacity to build community and to compromise and to be altruistic, that is, share with others. But the greater the level of fear and threat, the less capacity we have for community and compromise and being generous. The division in Paul's community, as Paul outlines it, is a division between eloquent wisdom and the wisdom of the cross. There's philosophical, rational ways that the people of Paul's time understood the world and explained what was going on and how they used that to understand their own lives and make their own decisions. And Paul has said that those ways are ways that lead to their own death. Think about your own moral beliefs, your own personal philosophies, your own ideologies, whether they be liberal or conservative or centrist, whatever they might be, and how you will fight to the death for what you believe. Back in 1959, Lawrence Hall wrote a book entitled The Ledge. And it's a story of a fisherman and his teenage son who on Christmas Day decide to go out winter duck hunting. And the way that they need to do this is they need to take this small skiff, this small boat, out to this section of land that during low tide is not covered with water. And after then they shoot the ducks, they gather them, and then take the skiff back to land. And so this fisherman and his son have done that. They have shot what they're going to shoot. They are there to gather those ducks together. They're back on this small section of land, and they can't find the boat to return them safely to the coast. It has floated away. So he and his son are standing there on this ledge as the tide begins to rise. This is how Hall described the fisherman. When concerning all of the other occupations he might fill, the fisherman would sooner die than to be anything else. And after he started this trip, he realized he had forgotten the tobacco for his pipe. But even though his son said, "Let's go back and get it," he said he wasn't going to go back. And Hall describes him as a man who did things the way he set out to do them. He would dig in his heels to hold fast to what he thought was true. And through the last pages of the short story, the fisherman puts his teenage son on his shoulders, and slowly the water raises up and takes the lives of both. Right before the water reaches the face of the fisherman, the son says, "Is it time to swim yet?" And the fisherman says, "Not yet, not just yet." That even at the last minute, he's holding fast to his human constructs. And the water drowns. That, brothers and sisters, is the message of the cross. Anything else we hold fast to brings about our death and our destruction. But we will hold fast to that to the very end. The only way we can be set free from that selfishness and that sin is to be washed clean by being drowned first by the waters of baptism. And only after we have died can we be given life. We will remain divided as a people as long as we hold fast till death these human constructs. But we are united as a people, we are united as a church when God, through death and resurrection, brings us into being. The way the division in Paul's letter to the Corinthians seems to be expressed is that the battle is a battle for status. You get to chapters 11 and 12 of 1 Corinthians, you find out that there's an argument about whose spiritual gifts are the greatest in the community. It's believed that those who can speak in tongues and those who can interpret the speaking in tongues have a greater spiritual gift than the rest of the community. So it's a battle of status. Who has the high place and who has the low place? Sam Wells, who was the dean of chapel at Duke University before heading over to London to be at St. Martin in the Field, in his book Improvisation, talks about this problem of status. He says, and where we find ourselves now in a conversation of status is that the assumption we have is that if it is strong, then it's wrong. If it's strong and high status, it's wrong. If it's weak and low status, it's right. And the battle becomes then who has high and who has low status. But what he proposes, that depending on where we find ourselves in our lives, there are times when we take high status and there are times when we assume low status. A part of our Christian character is to know when it's necessary to do which. It's not a battle of one being right over and against another. It's that living in the tension of both together. And so it fascinates me about what the possibilities would be if we as a Christian community took this understanding of status to our conversations about some of the challenges we face in our community. For instance, the conversation on universal health care. And what fascinates me about this conversation of universal health care is a criticism that we don't want to go to socialized medicine. And yet the people I hear leveling that criticism are those who are eligible for Medicare, which is socialized medicine for the elderly. But they're the ones with the money and the voice and the power, and so they try to shape the conversation. What happens if you take that status away and the concern becomes the well-being of every American citizen? Is it really a battle what's right and wrong, or is it a fight to see who has the best status? And likewise, as we deal with those living in poverty, you know, we split that right down the middle again, and that is just keep giving and keep giving. And there are those who say if they don't work, they should not eat. And so the battle becomes one or the other. And there's a truth in the book entitled Toxic Charity that Christians after the federal government do stand the greatest risk of creating dependency among people. But if it's not a battle of status, who's right and who's wrong, it allows us to take a look at the nuances of the conversation. Are you aware that there are people who the only housing they can afford is a room that has no kitchen to it? And because of that, they have nowhere to prepare food to eat if they could afford it. I know of one family that lives in a house, 7 apartments, 1 kitchen, 1 bathroom for all 7 apartments. How do you find time to make a meal? So craziness, what happens if we put our differences aside and say, is there a possibility in this community to create a place that somewhat resembles those old home ec sections of schools years ago when I was in school, where you have kitchen after kitchen lined up, and people can reserve a kitchen for a certain time with a registered dietitian present who gives them guidance on how to prepare a meal, so the family can actually prepare a meal together and sit down and eat that meal, because we know that families that eat together stand a better chance. But if we're so busy trying to be right, we won't be creative. Peter Marti, in his column in the Lutheran most recently, told the story of the French abbot Bernard of Clairvaux in a vision that Bernard had. This vision was an angel carrying a water pitcher in one hand and a torch in the other. Marty asked why this odd combination of water pitcher and torch, and his answer is the torch would allow the angel to burn up the pleasures of heaven. The pitcher would give the angel the means for quenching the fires of hell. Then once heaven and hell were out of the picture, people might quit loving God for the sake of transaction. That is, loving God to get into heaven or avoid hell. And if people stop loving God for the sake of transaction, they might simply love God for God's own sake. So be foolish this week. Now, better than that, be a moron this week. Because if you look at the Greek word for foolish, it's the root for the word moron. So would you go out in the world with me this week and be a moron with me? Amen.